Hello, everybody. It's my 50th anniversary coming up, as you know. And we're supposed to be celebrating this event. I'm not sure what there is to celebrate. It seems, for one thing, that 50 years is not very much time. It's just a second in the life of the soul. And more than that, you know, when you look at a mountain from down below, it can seem awfully high, but when you're flying in an airplane at 35,000 feet, it's hardly noticeable. It's more than just a sort of little bump. It's often made me think also of the waves on the ocean. When you're down there and you see all those towering waves, it seems like quite an exciting event. But you get up at 30,000 feet and it looks, for all you can tell, that the ocean is just completely flat. And so we have our human view of our accomplishments and what we've done in our lives and so on. But when I think of the divine view and looking down, I just think that I must be an embarrassment to Master and the gods and the angels. It's just what I've wanted to accomplish, I still have a long way to go. There's eternity ahead of me. And of all of us, because I don't want to make it too personal. So to talk of a 50th year anniversary is not all that big a deal, in my opinion. And yet I know that in terms of human years, it adds up to something. In terms of a human life, it's a fairly long period. I was reading today, as a matter of fact, a story of P.G. Woodhouse, whom I know you know that I love. And I was just amazed at the skill of his writing, of his inventiveness, of his marvelous command of English, of his timing. And the more I went on in my amazement, the more I thought, my God, I could never do a thing like that. Then suddenly I realized that he probably couldn't either. That the answer to it is not to think, can I or can't I? Or what are the problems involved here and how do I address them? Or what facts do I have to have at my command before I can address them competently? You just get into it and do it. And that's really something that I've learned on this path. And after 50 years, people sort of expect you to have a few words of wisdom to share with others. Well, I haven't much, but I do have a few things that I think would be worthwhile sharing at this point. One of them is that many years ago, when I was put in charge of the Hollywood Church, I thought, well, now I've got to start taking this job of lecturing seriously. For 7 years or something like that, let's see, I came in 48 and I didn't actually begin lecturing until 49. So anyway, 6 years. I had not taken it seriously because I thought, well, what good does it do anyway? You just get up there and spout and people go home and forget what you've said. But then I came upon the discovery every now and then, people's lives had been changed. I began to realize this is something I must take seriously because it does do good after all. I used to think it was my bad karma that put me out in the public, while all those disciples with good karma could stay at home and meditate. But then, when I was put in charge, I thought, well, I've really got to work on it. And then it happened once that I didn't have the time to prepare for a talk because I had too many things to do on Saturday. And I arrived pretty well, well unprepared. And a writer likes to think of a new word, and I couldn't come up with a new word. And afterwards, I was amazed that people, more than usually, said how much they had enjoyed the talk. And I thought, well, that's an interesting coincidence, and left it at that. Well, after a few weeks or months, the same thing happened again, and I didn't have the time to prepare. And more people than usually said how much they had liked the talk. And then it happened once more, and I thought, well, good heavens, if people are going to like it better if I don't work at it, Why do all that work unnecessarily? And so from then on, I began not preparing my talks, and I found that I got a lot better at it. Well, I had a few other experiences in my life that helped to take me deeper into that thought. When I wrote Cities of Light, I don't remember the year, but I had written already, I think that month, 7 books. It was a period of seclusion on my part, but I had to come out of it in a week. And Padma was saying that we need to have a book on Ananda, Cities of Light, in fact. And I thought, well, a week is just, I don't have the time to do that, I can't possibly do it. And she sort of nagged at me, saying, but we need it. And my own conscience nagged at me and said, yeah, I know. And so finally, I said, well, I can't possibly do it, but maybe Master can. And it was a very interesting experience for me, because I didn't have the time to think the thing through. I just had to open the floodgates and let it happen. And right within that period of time was when Mukdan came down and for some reason pulled the wrong switch, and I lost everything I'd done that day. And I just was too discouraged that day to do any more. It turned out that I had to do the book in 4 days. And what was amazing to me was how very well it came out. Only the first 2, possibly 2.5 chapters needed real editing, and the rest just flowed as if it had already been well thought out. And I thought, well, that's great. I can see that Master has a certain capacity here that I don't have. And that's what I noticed also in lecturing, that when I gave it over to him, that then things happened a lot more smoothly and better, and inspirations came that I would sort of sit back mentally and think, well, gee, I wish I'd thought of that. But I hadn't thought of it, it just was given to me. Well, then another thing happened, and that was the story of superconsciousness. You remember that. Danny and Prahlad were trying to get Warner to get to accept my writing a book on meditation, and I proposed the title Meditation for Starters, and they liked the idea, and I did the recording for it, as you know, with the Land of Golden Sunshine, is that it? And Land of Mystery, I forget, anyway, that Meditation for Starters thing. And then my introduction to meditation, it was all the outline that then all I needed to do to write the book, I could have done it with my left hand tied behind my back, so to speak, because the notes were all there. All I had to do was flush them out with examples and so on. And so I had been putting it off, you know. I had the tour for Warner in the fall. I had the heart operation. I had the book to do for Workman, which I had to finish a month after the heart operation. And then I did Do It Now, which seemed like the perfect timing, because I had those sayings already fresh in my mind. All I needed to do was work over them. And I still thought, well, I'll be able to do this very easily. And then Warner called me and said they didn't like that title. And the joke on them is that this title's selling better than the other one. But anyway, they wanted superconsciousness. And I, you know, you can't just plaster a new title on a book. If you have a new book, you have a new concept. If you have a new concept, you've got to, I mean, a new title, you've got to write a new book. And so I decided, well, I've got to. But it took a little sort of squaring away. And they gave me till the end of June. I had a 2-week tour already scheduled. I couldn't get out of it, going back to Chicago and Denver. And I had, therefore, a total of 2 months to write a book that I estimated should have taken me 2 years, but at the very least 1 year. And again, I said to Master, well, I can't possibly do this, but you're going to have to do it. And so it's not that I sat back there and prayed and waited helplessly for guidance. I threw myself into the breach, but I knew that he'd be there and help me through. And in fact, the book got finished. It was the best book I'd done so far. And I say was, because I think the Hindu Way is even better. But anyway, I got it to Warner. Alan sent it by FedEx on the 29th of June, and they got it the 30th of June, which was their deadline. And it was in that period that I had to go north right away to give lectures in Seattle and Portland. But Derek Bell was coming, and David Miller had been desperately asking me for the melodies for the Mystic Harp. So I had 3 days before I left, and I figured, well, 1 day for packing, 2 days for writing the melodies. And again, because I was still in that mood, I just sort of turned it over to Master, sort of plunged into it superconsciously. And you know, one essence of superconsciousness is to be solution conscious, not problem conscious. And so without allowing myself the luxury of thinking it's difficult, I just thought, well, it has to be, therefore it will be, and here it is. And in those 2 days, I did most of the melodies for that album. Others had already been written before. Now, there's a point to all this, and I think it's a very important one for the growth of Ananda and for my 50 years of discipleship. And that is, what is my definition of discipleship? It isn't sitting around talking about the guru so much, and yet I have to say that in all these 50 years, I've spent a great deal of my time meditating on Master, on what he did, on what he said, trying to understand what he said and did more deeply. It's been sort of the focal point of my entire life. But at the same time, discipleship means, I think, something more. And in this, Master encouraged me, because, you know, I remember back in 1950, Master told me, your work is writing and lecturing. And I said, but sir, hasn't everything been written that needs to be written? And he looked a little shocked. He said, don't say that. He said, much more is needed. And in fact, this is the role of a disciple, not to be a parent, not to be a record player, just repeating the words of the guru without understanding what those words are, but trying to go deep into them, trying to understand them more deeply, and then also trying to enlarge on that understanding, trying to show how what he did is relevant. And this is, to me, the amazing thing. In a way, I really am just a parent. Not an unthinking parent, I hope, but somebody who I'm not trying to create. I haven't created anything new. Everything I've done has been a spin-off, so to speak, from what Master gave us. The more deeply I've gone into his work, the more I've just been amazed at how extensive his mission is. Its potential, far more than any other teacher, and although I have not meditated on their teachings to the extent that I have on his, obviously, nonetheless, I've had to refer what he said to what they said to see if I've understood well. Living in a vacuum, thinking in a vacuum, you don't get as clear a picture as if you see that, have I understood it? Is it something? Because he'd never contradict what other great masters had said. And therefore, if they all agree, you can be more confident that you've understood than if it looks as if one is saying one thing and the other is saying something quite different. So I've been aware of what other people have taught, but I have not encountered ever, anywhere, even in history, any teacher or teaching that is so broad in its scope, in its potential for changing an entire era. Most of them talk about the individual, about going into your own self. This, of course, is what the path is really all about. But he gave me another mission. I haven't been able, and in fact, I remember Brother Bhaktananda used to be quite envious of my creativity. The funny thing is that I was envious of his lack of creativity. I was envious of his being able to be a humble devotee who just thought of God and loved God and didn't think in terms of broad vistas of meaning, which I was cursed with by my own nature in a way. I could not be otherwise. When some of the people in SRF used to speak of this as being ego, I don't know. All I can say is I had no choice. My interest lay that way, my absorption lay that way. I could only go, and it would have taken a great deal more effort on the part of this ego to suppress that than to flow with it. But the thing that has come out of it has nothing to do with me, has nothing to do with my abilities or my talents. Rather, even in those, quote, so-called abilities and talents, I found that by tuning into him, suddenly I was able to do things that I could never do, often in music, for example, because I haven't had training as a composer. Yes, I studied piano for years. I don't know how good I was. I don't think I was particularly good, but I wasn't particularly bad. So let's say sort of super mediocre. And when I was writing music, afterwards I would think, how on earth did I do that? I don't understand. I don't know where those chords came from. I don't know chords. I don't know what the names of the chords I write are. I don't know anything about chord progression. But when I tune in to him, and when I say, well, it's got to be so, therefore it is, suddenly I do know. And it's not at all that I'm just beating around in the dark. I know exactly what I'm doing. The greatest musical expert in the world could challenge me, and I'd stand up for what I've done, because I know it's right. After it's over, I don't know how the heck I ever knew. And the same is true, I think, for just about everything. I give a talk, and I have no idea what I said afterwards, because I just sort of give it back to God. But it's not my talent, you see. It's something that I have put myself in tune with Master, and not only ask his spirit to do it, but also been absolutely fascinated by the extraordinary scope of that spirit, by the extraordinary scope of his glimpse, his understanding of the needs of this particular age. Now, what he taught today wouldn't have been true 200 years ago, wouldn't have been true in the time of Shankaracharya. It was right for now, and it was absolutely right. That's why I say he is the avatar for Dwapara Yuga, at least for this beginning part of Dwapara Yuga. And we all enter into that. Now, the same thing with starting communities. I don't know how I've done it. I seem, to my mind, to have been just about the last person I would have chosen to start a community. And I don't say that out of some kind of mock humility, nor do I say it to be funny. I really mean it, because I'm not a committee kind of person. I'm not a group kind of worker. I do need to sort of dig down inside myself and come up with these solutions without talking about them in a group and saying, okay, now folks, what do we decide? And yet I've started a community, and I can't expect everybody to do it the way I've done it. And therefore, I have to say that that too is one of the ways that we can get into the heart of something. And I've seen it happen too, when I've been in a group where we had to decide together, it wasn't my decision, that there is, even in the heart of a group, a certain heart, a certain center. We get in tune with that center. It's not that we all agree. I myself don't agree at all with myself. I'm constantly challenging things that I've thought or written or whatever. And in fact, they have to stand and deliver. They have to prove themselves. And in the process, I'm saying, wait a minute, does that really work? And sometimes it happens that I've gone to bed thinking really well of something that I've written, that it really said it the way I wanted to. In the morning, I look at it and I thought, my God, did I do that? What a fool. It didn't work at all. Well, we have to do that with ourselves and with a group. So I don't mean that we have to have the kind of unanimity of lockstep togetherness, but we don't want that kind of nagging criticism either. We need to say, okay, here may be a better solution, not to have the kind of attitude that says, well, I don't like this, I don't like that. What are you doing that for? What have we done that for? That doesn't work. But if we can basically agree on where we're going and what we're trying to do, there not only is room for, but there's a crying need for that kind of discriminating disagreement that can add to the pile rather than detract from it. And in that way, Ananda is actually a wonderful example to the world. I was just mentioning in a talk here in Italy a couple of Sundays ago, I think it was, of maybe it was even last Sunday, I don't remember now, but I was mentioning how in our committee meetings, there's always agreement at the end. There may be questions, there may be talking, but it's always in a spirit of unity, of we're doing this together. Let's add to the heap, let's not just sort of scatter everything to the winds. Let's not sit there and grumble and say it won't work. But I've seen that at the end of these meetings, there's always, you don't need to take a vote. People agree. And one of the basic reasons for that is, two of the basic reasons. One is we ask what is good for everybody, not just what do I want. In fact, never say, what do I want? I never write that way. And never compose that way. I say, what does God want? What is needed? And what is good for everybody? In that case, for example, when writing music, which particular progression of chords or of melody will help the person listening? Which one will uplift him, or which will leave him sort of confused and not knowing quite why I did that? And the other thing is to ask, what does God want? In other words, everything that you do, because you can't sit there and wait for a voice to speak out of the clouds. It doesn't happen that way. But what does happen is that you say, you hold what you're thinking up to the divine will. And if it doesn't feel right, you know it's not right. If it adds to the inspiration that you feel from superconsciousness, from your attunement, if it adds to that, if it resonates with that, then it's good. That's why I say that every note that I've written, every chord that I've written, has been sincere, because I've done it that way. It isn't that I've liked it or thought it was a convenient out or anything. In fact, it's been an advantage in a way not to know that much about composition, because I didn't know the rules and couldn't say, well, it's good enough. If it didn't work, it wouldn't be good enough. I couldn't come up with a convenient answer because I wouldn't know it. Well, the same thing with the starting of Ananda and with our continuing with Ananda in the years to come. The more we can do it with a spirit of what's good for everybody, and everybody thinking not in lockstep togetherness, but in harmony, that we all, for one thing, and for one very obvious thing, are trying to do a good thing. And with that basic thought, we have to respect other people, even if they disagree with us, that they too are trying to do a good thing. Therefore, we have respect for each other's opinions, even when we don't agree. The next thing is that we all want to do a godly thing. And in this, the options become fewer. And yet, they're all there. And the more we try to attune ourselves to them, the more we find that there is a certain joy that comes. And that's what happens at our meetings. Ananda is a fantastic example of working together. So when I look back to my life with Master, I recognize several things that he said to me that indicate to me now quite clearly that he did see me working alone. He saw me not working with the other disciples. I had a different kind of work to do. But he also saw me working in tune with him. And I do not feel myself to be working separately from his other disciples. And that's the next point that I wanted to make, that there should not be a sense of rivalry. Oh, he did it this well, let's see if I can do it better. There shouldn't be that. There should be the thought of competing against ourselves, of doing the best thing we can possibly do. But there is a temptation, because SRF attacked us in the law courts, and there's a temptation to feel, to make comparisons that are unflattering to them and flattering to ourselves. Not only is that bad for our own egos, but it's bad for Master's work. We need to understand that we are all like the fingers of one hand. Each finger has its own function. Each finger is different from all the others. And each disciple of Master and each ray of Master's disciples, each one will be doing a function, but each will complete a larger picture. And so what I plead with you, if I have any legacy to leave you, it is this, that we always, in our hearts and in spirit, if we're not allowed to do so, in fact, work with Master's disciples, never against them. Work always in a spirit of respect and harmony, and never in a spirit of rivaling what they are doing, or feeling, well, they aren't doing it as well as they ought to because we're doing it that way. Don't think that way. They have their reasons for what they're doing. And I know those people, as none of you do. And I know that they're great souls. No matter what facts we see, those are trivial. Each person, as I say, if we look at our lives, we can see so many things we could have done better. Of course we could. If we look at our lives, imagine them even from a higher perspective, thinking of, a God's eye view of our lives, for example. I think on the one hand, again, I like P.G. Woodhouse because his characters seem to me to be sort of a God's eye view of humanity, lovable but faintly ridiculous. And I can't help thinking that that's how God looks at me and at all of us disciples and at you all, that we're doing our best and at the same time, I'm not going to speak for you, but I can surely speak for myself. I must be an embarrassment to them too. That why couldn't I just do it a little bit better? Why couldn't I have a little bit more common sense? But we're what fate has given them to work with, and so they work with us. I can imagine it would have been absolutely wonderful if God had incarnated a whole group of avatars to launch this mission in the West. But that doesn't seem to be the way he does these things. He puts his mission in the hands of an avatar to start with, and then it sort of manages to get shuffled around by a bunch of people like me, and we do our best. And I hope that that counts on the good side of the ledger. But I wish, for example, that I had been able to be another Rajarshi. I wish that I'd been able to be in Samadhi this whole time instead of finding my mind going towards serving the work. And yet, then I remember that Master said your life is one of intense activity and meditation, and it certainly has been that. And I realize again that if I had been in Samadhi, I could not care less about the work that I've had to do. It wouldn't mean anything to me, because the truth is, and I don't want this to go any further except to these hundreds of people who are going to see this, and that is that it doesn't mean a damn to me. I just do it because I think it's a good thing to do, and I'm trying, but nothing matters. There's only one thing that matters, and that is our love for God. And there again, if a P.G. Woodhouse can get inside his story and launch himself into these absolutely preposterous and impossible things and do such a wonderful job of it, if I can launch myself into an impossible work like a book or whatever, and do a passable job of it because I've allowed that that thing to come from inside myself and from solution consciousness, as opposed to working at it in terms of thinking from outside. Now, how do I put this together? How do I do it? But how? It wouldn't work that way. But if we can just have the faith that whatever we have to do will come from inside ourselves. Now, here's an amazing thing about life. Because life gives us repeatedly all kinds of hardships, tragedies, difficulties. And yet, looking back after many years, we see that that was a good thing. Unless that had happened, I wouldn't have been able to do this. Unless that tragedy had occurred, I would have gotten stuck in a cul-de-sac and never come out of it. Again and again, if we can have faith in God, that whatever He gives to us, pleasant, unpleasant, just doesn't enter the picture. It doesn't matter. But many times we rebel and think, oh, why does He want this? Anything but this. But if we can have the faith to understand that He is guiding our lives and go along with it, like a good surfboard rider who goes with the wave instead of thinking, I wish the wave would go another direction. If we could take that attitude in our lives and launch ourselves into whatever it is that God has given us to do, or that we feel from inside, because mind you, people often say, well, I just don't want to know what God wants. Well, He works through you, through your own impulse. He works through what you know you have inside. But then if you give it to Him and let Him do it, and don't think you've got to control that wave yourself, and work from your own center, or if it's a group working, work from the center of the group, and not abrasively each one separate from the group, because that's when ego gets into the picture. Always refer any doubt, any question, back to your own center, back to the center in the group, back to the God within, and you'll see that somehow it flows. You don't have to understand exactly why or how. I know that in Reflections on Living, Vidura mentioned several times that you just can't even understand how Ananda succeeds. And of course, you don't have to understand. It works because the spirit's right. The mechanics of it are taken care of on another level. But the more we think with worries and furrowed brow about how is it going to work, the more we interfere with that flow. But if with faith we dive in, like after the fire in 76, there was no reason we should have survived that fire. There was no reason. We had no insurance. We had no money. We didn't have huge donations. How did we survive it? Because we believe in God. And we just dived in. I think one of my favorite photographs is that one of Asha cleaning the cinders and burned limbs of trees away from the ground with a big, blissful smile on her face. That's the attitude with which we've faced every test. And we found that God is always there. He's always with you. But we sometimes can close the door if we worry too much and if we think too much in terms of what are the mechanics. Because those mechanics work, take care of themselves. Sure, you don't want to be stupid about it, but in using your best intelligence, that's all that can be really asked of you. So what have I learned in my 50 years of discipleship? Well, I've learned one thing above all, that my only goal is to be an ever better disciple. And I hope that by the time I leave this body, that Master will say, good job, Walter.